This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
This is really special. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented.
I have a great warm spot for your country. He loves his country and I love our country. And we also have two countries that have gotten along for the longest period of time.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Hello.
Hello.
Another week, another special episode of Politics Weekly Westminster. This time we're recording on Friday. It's midday. Is it midday? It's 12:30. And Pippa, you've literally just landed this morning after joining the Prime Minister on his trip to meet Donald Trump. The plan was to record this pretty much as soon as you got off the plane. But of course, there is no such thing as a quiet day in news. So as we were preparing to do this podcast, Annalise Dodds, the Minister of State for Development, resigned quite dramatically from the government over its choice to slash its foreign aid budget. Pippa, tell us more about that story before we get stuck into the meat of the DC trip.
Yeah, I was just sitting at my desk waiting to, actually having some breakfast, having not eaten for several hours, quite a lot of hours, and I got a phone call from somebody that said to me, Annalise Dodds is about to resign. And I have to say, this wasn't a huge surprise. Mm. I know her quite well. I know her thinking on development. And I figured that after the Prime Minister's decision to slash the aid budget to pay for big defence rises, that she would be among one of those cabinet ministers that we know aren't happy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really was a spectacular return to London for the Prime Minister to see one of his most senior ministers. She attends cabinet, but is not a full cabinet minister, announcing her resignation. Well, we had it first, and then she announced it on Twitter moments later. And it's definitely worth reading her resignation letter in full. I haven't seen a response yet from Starmer himself. Do you think he's still asleep? Do you think he knows that one of his most senior ministers has resigned?
I'm not 100% sure he does know. Well, actually, if he was asleep, someone would have woken him up by now.
Right.
But yeah, I think the first he will have known about it would have been, well, this morning at some point. He, like me, well, actually, not like me, I got stuck on the M11 getting here, but he probably was blue-lighted all the way down from the airfield back to Downing Street. It's probably in meetings.
I'm hoping his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, has a subscription to The Guardian and picked up on the story as soon as he saw it and went to wake up the Prime Minister straight away. And do you think he'll be personally upset by this?
I think he will. I mean, it was really clear, both from on the US trip and actually even before that, that Downing Street press conference earlier this week that you went to, Kieran, and his statement in the Commons, that this was not an easy decision. He says no Labour Prime Minister would want to stand here and cut the international development budget. It had already, of course, come down from the legal target of 0.7% during the pandemic to 0.5%. I would think that he will be not just disappointed to have, you know, politically to have lost a cabinet minister, but also feel quite sad that she felt so profoundly about this that she felt she had no option but to quit.
Yeah, and she is a very loyal. She has always been a very loyal minister, never spoken out, certainly not one of the usual suspects, not a troublemaker. So that kind of makes it even more painful.
Yeah,
exactly. All right, well, now back to the meat of what the last few days were supposed to be about. You have just got off the plane, as we said. How do you think the Prime Minister is feeling about the trip, apart from the resignation of one of his senior ministers?
Well, before that, Keir Starmer came back on the Prime Minister's plane, which we travelled to and from back from Washington with him on last night, just after takeoff. Normally on these trips, stay and have a slightly longer chat, all off the record with journalists, chew the fat a little bit, discuss the football normally. This time, he was obviously absolutely knackered. I think partly because of the preparation he put into the trip and the fact that it was such a consequential, momentous moment, probably the biggest meeting of a prime minister, a significant meeting of a prime minister and a president in post-Cold War history. And he bore that burden heavily and dutifully. So when he came back to see us, he basically said, I'm not going to stay for long. I'm not going to chat, really. We asked him how he thought the trip had gone. Was he happy? He said yes. He gave us a thumbs up. And then he headed back off to the front of the plane to sleep. And we then chewed the fat ourselves and talked about how we thought it had gone. And look, I mean, for months they've been laying the groundwork with building relationships with American politicians, with the Trump team, with visits out there from people like Morgan McSweeney and David Lammy. Some of Starmer's closest aides went out a few days early just to make sure that there were no hiccups. But as we were told when we arrived, when we're speaking to senior government officials, you can prepare all you like. But the reality is that Donald Trump is an incredibly unpredictable individual. And so you've done all your homework. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to pay off. And there's a lot that we don't know about what he's planning to do in Ukraine and elsewhere. So they went into, I'd say, with a sort of sense of slight trepidation. So they will have been relieved, and we'll get into exactly what happened in the mad 24 hours in Washington, but they will have been relieved that actually it kind of came off pretty well.
And you were able to record some of the trip on your phone, weren't you? Shall we have a listen to that now?
I'm sitting on the Prime Minister's plane about 30,000 feet above the Atlantic as we head over to Washington, D.C. for his first meeting with Donald Trump since he became president. It's a big moment and everybody's feeling a bit apprehensive about what tomorrow may bring. I think it's fair to say that this is the most precarious moment for European security in decades. Trump has withdrawn support from Ukraine and instead he's aligned the US with Moscow, and that's overturned years of transatlantic consensus. Government officials that I've spoken to say that they're trying to focus on the bigger picture, which is ending the war, obviously, and also stepping up European security. A wee while ago, Starmer came back on the plane for a chat with journalists and he was quite clear about the message that he'd be taking to the White House. He'd be warning Trump that Vladimir Putin would just invade Ukraine again unless the US provides what they describe as security guarantees for any peace deal. But it's already clear that persuading Trump to provide that backstop, which basically means air, logistical, comms or other support for any British or other European troops that may form a peacekeeping force in Ukraine, is not going to be an easy task. And one of the advantages of travelling on the PM's plane is that we have Wi-Fi right across the flight across the Atlantic. And moments after our chat with Starmer ended and he went back up to his seat in presumably number 1A, right up at the front, news arrived that Trump had told his cabinet he'd got no plans to provide those security guarantees that Ukraine and European countries are wanting. And he told them, we're going to have Europe do that. So let's see. Government aides have told me that these talks are just the start of the process and we should manage our expectations. One said it would be a dangerous game for them to tell me what they would regard as a measure of success in advance. Probably quite wise. But this much we know. Starmer will try to be collaborative and constructive with Trump and, I'm told, try to dial down the volume in public. But Trump is a notoriously unpredictable president. And as we continue our journey to the United States, it really feels like tomorrow anything could happen.
Mr. President.
Please, ma'am, go ahead.
Mr. President, what would you be willing to do if Vladimir Putin did not stick to the terms of any deal on Ukraine?
If he not what?
He did not stick to the terms of any deal on Ukraine because he has a history of not sticking to his word when it comes to international agreements.
I think he'll keep his word. I think he's, I've spoken to him. I've known him for a long time now. We had to go through the Russian hoax together. That was not a good thing. It's not fair. That was a rigged deal and had nothing to do with Russia. It was a rigged deal with inside the country. And they had to put up with that, too. They put up with a lot. It wasn't just us. They had to put up with it, with a phony story that was made up. I've known him for a long time now, and I think he will. I don't believe he's going to violate his word. I don't think he'll be back when we make a deal. I think the deal is going to hold. Now, they're going to have security. You're going to have security. Yep. You're going to have soldiers. I know France wants to be there. He's the president has said he wants to have soldiers there. I don't think we're going to even be necessary, but I don't think there'll be any problem with keeping the deal with the security.
Mr. President,
you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I mean, the deal, if we get it, is going to be hugely important. I don't think it would have happened if
the space hadn't been created for it by yourself. But if there's a deal in, we've got to make sure it's a deal that lasts, that is not temporary.
I'm just sitting in the East Room of the White House at a massive press conference, just waiting for President Donald Trump and the Prime Minister to walk into the room. A huge room with journalists filling every seat and also huge numbers of cameras along the back of the room, standing room only along one side. I think there's US officials coming in now, the British side already in their seats, including the Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, Foreign Secretary David Lammy and others. There are two podiums at the top of the room with British and American flags behind them. We've already had about half an hour in the Oval Office shouting out questions, many of them from the British press, to primarily the President on everything from Ukraine and security guarantees to trade with the UK, to freedom of speech and other issues which have been of interest to us all. And the President and Prime Minister are now walking into the room.
Officials are clapping on the US side. And American journalist is standing up. The British press, of course, is staying in their seats because he's not our head of state. Here they come. And then Trump's smiling from the podium. Let's hear what he's got to say.
Thank you very much for your honour. Today it's my privilege to welcome the Prime Minister of a very special place, the United Kingdom, to the White House. Prime Minister's
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, they're treating me with the respect with which I deserve, Kieran. And even if only you and the rest of the Guardian team said yes, ma'am, to me in the office, it's my new rule. I'm going to instigate it. I will not be referred to as anything less. It was pretty odd. So what you heard there was what's called a spray, which is when a few journalists, and it normally is a much smaller number than went in yesterday, they go into the Oval Office for the beginning of the meeting between the two principals, as we call them. So in this case, Keir Starmer and Donald Trump. And they sit on armchairs in front of the fireplace.
Those gold armchairs.
Those gold armchairs. Yeah. And then you have these sofas, which act sort of like as a protective ring. And we all sort of stand back towards the president's desk, the Roosevelt desk, I think it is, which is in sort of the famous bay window. Although we're not allowed to touch the desk. They're very strict about that. And there's normally maybe, I don't know, sort of 20 journalists combined from both sides, from both countries. Mostly it's cameras. And then, you know, we get sort of invited in because I guess we're the traveling party. We've come all that way. This time it was substantially more. It was probably more like 40 journalists. And the room was crammed anyway, because not only was it the two principals, but you also had on the UK side, Morgan McSweeney, David Lammy, and Jonathan Powell, the National Security Advisor, plus a host of other officials. And on the US side, facing them, staring them down across the coffee table, was Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, Pete Hegseth, the Defence Secretary, and J.D. Vance as well, the Vice President. So it was like a really like heavyweight contingent in there, which was interesting in its own right. And then what happened is that the media kind of like chanced their arm and shout out questions. And I've been in the Oval Office before, very privileged to in my job. And what happens is that maybe two or three of the questions are answered. And there's not sort of a strict rotation as to who asks them. It's just whoever shouts loud enough or catches the president's eye. But Donald Trump basically did a mini press conference and we're in there for half an hour, which is significantly longer than any that I've been to in the Oval Office before. So Trump started like catching people's eye and I was like, oh, well, you better start shouting. So I was like, Mr. President, Mr. President. And eventually he sort of said, yeah, you ma'am. And I got to ask my question that you heard. And not only did he respond, but also Keir Starmer responded. And that was quite unusual, I think, in that dynamic, because most of the questions were directed at Trump and most of the responses were from him. But it clearly was something that he felt strongly enough about to feel that he wanted to say as well.
Yeah, you got some really interesting questions, which kind of led a lot of the news coverage this morning. But what's your takeaway now about the relationship between the two of them? You know, they put on a good show of unity. How did you read their body language? Did it seem like they're genuinely friendly or is this all for the cameras?
So I think that there is definitely a degree of warmth there. Clearly, they're from very different political backgrounds. And I think they think about the world in a different way as well. Keir Starmer is very sharp, detailed, precise intellectually. And Donald Trump is kind of like an enigma. I mean, he's obviously very canny. And he sort of plots his way through life and work and business and now politics. And he doesn't give much away. but he's much harder to read. But when they were asked what they had in common, the one thing they both said is that they both loved their countries. And I think the personal relationship is really important with Trump, partly because he is, let's face it, an egomaniac. So there has to be a degree of flattery there. Mm. And there was lots of sort of, it was quite weird, almost like Starmer was mirroring Trump's language, saying things like, this is unprecedented,
and historic,
lauding praise on him for being the one that was leading the way towards a Ukrainian peace deal. So there's the flattery bit, but you can't overdo it, because if you do, he'll see it as condescension.
Right.
And what some senior British government officials were saying was that Donald Trump will like the fact that Keir Starmer is pretty down to earth and not condescending. And then the second thing is that in the personal relationship is that he has to make him feel like everything that he's suggesting would benefit America. Has to be seen through the America First prism for a foreign policy that he has. Whether that's Ukraine, whether that's a trade deal, whether that's a Chagos Island, whether that's Gaza, you know, all these areas, he has to be helped to see the benefit of it from the States. And the third thing is kind of playing to our strengths. And one of the big strengths we have is that Trump loves Britain and Trump loves the royal family. And of course, when Starmer first went in, he handed over a letter of invitation from King Charles to Trump to come to Scotland and discuss plans for a second state visit, an unprecedented, historic, magnificent, lavish, I don't know what other words we used, second state visit over to Britain, which he was clearly delighted about.
Perhaps you'd like to say what that very important paragraph...
Yes, so this is a letter from His Majesty the King. It's an invitation for a second state visit. This is really special. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. I think that just symbolises the strength of the relationship between us. So this is a very special letter.
So the personal bit is really important, but not just for its own sake. It helps because if you have the personal relationship, officials told us, with Donald Trump, you can then get away with saying the tough stuff because he'll like you, but he'll also respect you for having, frankly, the balls to stand up to him and to fight for your own national interests.
Obviously, Keir Starmer's relationship has been very much examined with Donald Trump. You also saw Peter Mandelson while you were out there, right? And what about him? How's he fitting in DC?
He was in his absolute element.
I can imagine.
Kieran, it was... we arrived straight off the flight to the very beautiful British ambassador's residence in northern Washington, D.C. And it's you walk into this opulent reception room, which is got these tall, these grand marble columns. You've been there. You were a Washington correspondent. Crystal chandeliers.
Yeah.
There was tables outside on the terraces with champagne and I drank champagne because why wouldn't you, frankly, if you offered a glass? And the place was packed with lots of sort of Washington high society. So there were people there like Kash Patel, the FBI director, the new FBI director who Peter Mandelson introduced Keir Starmer to. There was Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator.
Mm.
Tina Brown, the New York editor,
probably
mainstay embassy parties.
Yeah.
And the place was rammed. And Peter Mandelson took to the stage and sort of gave this speech, which went on and on. And I was standing next to one of Keir Starmer's senior advisors who was kind of like, sotto voce, Peter, get off the stage now. Obviously, some way away.
It was his moment.
It's
his chance to shine. You can't get Peter Mandelson off the stage.
No, and it really did feel like it was his party. And when I arrived, he came over and said hello. And should I admit this? I was sort of teasing him about the size of his sitting room. Is this your sitting room? Not very big. And then he took me into the private sitting room to have a wee look around there well. So I had a little sneak view. He had a big fire in there. It wasn't that cold. He put a couple of logs on and it all looked very cozy and very nice. Keir Starmer, of course, was the main attraction at this party. We told it was a reception, sorry, not a party. Downing Street, we're very cross with us all calling it a party. And he stood up and he gave this very sort of warm speech about being in Washington. And then he said, I'm going to quote you a bit from it. He said, I've only just arrived, but already I can feel this real buzz around Washington right now. You can sense that there's a new leader. He's a true one-off, a pioneer in business, in politics. Many people love him. Others love to hate him. But to us, he's just Peter.
Very good.
Everyone really laughed like that. And after that, it was kind of seen as a good start to the visit. We all then crawled off back to our hotel and went to bed. He stayed in Blair House, which is the US president's guest house opposite the White House.
Just opposite the White House.
But yeah, I think Peter Mandelson is very quickly getting into all the corners of Washington society and the diplomatic world out there that he needs to. And it feels, got a very warm reception at the White House too. It feels like that could be, you know, for all the reasons we've talked about before, his sort of canniness and political guile could end up being an extremely good appointment.
It's funny, Peter Mandelson's predecessor, Karen Pierce, when she arrived in Washington, she was fantastic at those champagne parties, to the extent that one rather unkind minister used to call her Bubbles. But yes, Karen Pierce, unfortunately for her, obviously she arrived when it was lockdown and so was not able to throw these lavish champagne parties. And they then needed to do a bunch of repairs to the official residence and she was shunted off to, I have to say, a really beautiful house around the corner. But she was always fed up about not being able to throw as many parties in that house as she'd have liked. But let's get on to the substance of the actual talks. The trip was all supposed to be about Ukraine. Obviously, other things came up. We kind of got a lot of vague comments by Trump about what he might do to secure the peace in Ukraine. Keir Starmer's big ask was that there would be some kind of security backstop, maybe air cover for British and European troops provided by the Americans. Trump didn't quite say that. What do you think Starmer said to him, and do you think he came away with what he wanted?
So yes, Ukraine was the principal reason for Keir Starmer going over, and particularly Keir Starmer going over this week, because of course Emmanuel Macron sort of started rolling out European diplomacy with his trip to the White House in Washington. And later today, President Zelensky of Ukraine will be there for like potentially game-changing meeting, potentially signing an economic deal on critical minerals with the United States. Keir Starmer, number 10 aides, were keen to stress to us his particular meeting. Yes, it was a big deal. Of course it was a big deal. But it was part of a process that doesn't just involve him, doesn't just involve the UK. He was ultimately there to help persuade Donald Trump that any peace in Ukraine needs to be sustainable. I mean, that's ultimately it. Now, what does that mean? Being sustainable means that Vladimir Putin needs to be persuaded not to invade again, because he's invaded in 2014 in the Crimea, invaded 3 years ago, pushing into Donbass, the Donbass region and Donetsk and into eastern Ukraine. And despite signing a plethora of multinational agreements over the years, he has not stuck to his word. And Donald Trump has very closely and clearly aligned himself with Vladimir Putin, both personally through phone conversations and officials meeting each other at summits in the Middle East and Turkey, but also he's used the power of the state at the United Nations and aligned himself with Russia there as well. So Keir Starmer not only wanted to say this peace has to be sustainable, but he also wanted to get the message across that Vladimir Putin couldn't be trusted. And because Vladimir Putin couldn't be trusted, he was asking for what he's calling a backstop or a security guarantee, which is what Ukraine needs if a peace deal is signed. Britain and France have already put their hands up to lead some sort of multinational peacekeeping force. And that means there'd be boots on the ground. And they fear, and Ukraine fears, that a European presence would not be sufficient to deter Vladimir Putin from trying again and chancing his luck. And it'd be sort of one-offs, first of all. It'd be little flash points here or there, little incursions. But it would build. And it wouldn't necessarily just build in Ukraine. They could also push into the Baltic countries and even into Moldova or sort of the eastern flank of Europe, eventually Poland and Eastern Europe. That is the fear. And because they don't think that he can be trusted not to just push Europe about a bit to test them, they want the US to provide logistical, air intelligence, surveillance, communication support, so military support but not boots on the ground, backup, and crucially, in the event that Putin did break his word and there was another incursion, that they would be there to militarily to support any British or other NATO countries that got caught up in any ensuing battles.
Right. And I think the question was asked directly of Trump, right? If British soldiers come under fire, will you send in the planes to go and protect them? And he had this answer. He said, oh, I'm sure it won't be needed. You guys are tough enough. And then there was that, again, slightly excruciating moment where he turned to Keir Starmer and said, do you think you could take on Vladimir Putin on your own?
And Starmer laughed.
Yeah.
I mean, in a kind of horrified way.
You know, the British have been incredible soldiers, incredible military, and they can take care of themselves. But if they need help, I'll always be with the British, okay? I'll always be with them. But they don't need help. You look at their career,
You have done very well over the years, haven't you?
We have. I'm very proud of our country. And we've also always been backing each other up between our two countries. That is why this is the greatest alliance for prosperity and security I think the world has ever seen. Whenever necessary, we absolutely backed each other up, and that's at the core.
Could you take on Russia by yourselves?
Well...
All right, one or two more.
Then later on in the press conference, Trump was asked about NATO Article 5, which is the collective defence agreement, basically, between NATO countries. And he recommitted to it and said he did back it.
Yeah.
So
I
think it's his strategy, actually. I think in as much as chaos is his strategy when it comes to deals, so vagueness is his strategy when it comes to Ukraine, because it's almost like he doesn't want Russia to know exactly what the US would do. It wants to keep them guessing. And he reckons that Vladimir Putin would not take the chance of angering the US because there would be all hell to pay. He thinks the fact that the US and Ukraine are set to sign this huge critical minerals deal, rare earth deal, potentially today, certainly a starting point of discussions today in Washington, means that there would be large numbers of US civilians working across eastern Ukraine, that American companies will have invested billions of dollars in Ukraine, and therefore America would have a very real economic stake in the country. And he thinks that that would be a deterrent. American people, civilians, and American money, in his mind, being a businessman, is equivalent of American might. Keir Starmer thinks that can be one element of security guarantees, but they want more.
Yeah, and presumably that's Zelensky's gamble as well. Because there's nothing in the draft text that we've seen of this deal, this critical minerals deal, that actually provides any concrete security guarantees. But I guess Zelensky is thinking, look, I'll give up some of our mineral wealth because getting American companies in here will actually help give us some security militarily as well.
Yeah.
But of course, it wasn't just Ukraine. Trade also came up. We kind of again got some slightly vague comments by Donald Trump, but seemed to be positive for Britain that he wasn't thinking of putting tariffs on the UK, at least not now. And then talk of a trade deal, which, oh my goodness, I mean, US-UK trade deal, I've been reporting on that for best part of a decade. let's see if it ever happens. To me, one of the most interesting things was talk of tech there, because there seems to be some suggestion, and our colleague Eleni Correa was writing about this recently, that the UK could kind of soft pedal some of its attempts to regulate the tech industry, potentially the AI industry, to please the US ahead of some kind of tech sector deal. Is that what you were picking up from Washington as well?
It was. And just to go back to Trump's remarks on trade, he at this press conference said that the US would make great trade agreements, I can't do accents, I shouldn't try, with the UK that would progress very quickly. And he said that Starmer had tried to persuade him against imposing tariffs, as you already said. He earned whatever the hell they pay him over there.
Yeah.
Derisory comments about British politicians' salaries. The US had originally been looking for a full trade agreement. And there's been different models of free trade agreements and trade deals being set out over the years. But what they seem to be honing in on, and we already knew this, is that sort of sector by sector trade deals. So rather than an overarching FTA, which might be difficult for British consumers and British NHS users and so on. And they think that the quickest one that they can reach is on tech, including AI, as you say, bioscience, space, all of these things.
So after all that, did you come out from this visit with a view that Keir Starmer can trust Donald Trump to stick by what he promised, or at least what he kind of vaguely suggested?
I think the big problem here is that he just doesn't know. He wants to be able to trust him. He has to be able to trust him. But experience shows us just how mercurial Donald Trump is. How he could make all these assurances one day and the next morning wake up and fire out messages on social media saying the exact opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's a wait and see. It's a watch this space.
Do you know, they've always said, when I was reporting in Washington, people always used to say Trump will say the thing that he's been told last by somebody in the room. Now, people often say this about political leaders, but I think the real triumph of this week, if nothing else, was to get Macron, Starmer and Zelensky all in front of Trump in the space of a week. That will have an effect. We'll see in the long term what that effect will end up being. I would also like to hear from other Labour MPs, I think, over the next few days, and we're going to be talking to quite a few next week, about how they feel just at the general tone of that love-in between Starmer and Trump. I think, you know, some people might have been hoping for a Hugh Grant Love Actually show of strength from Starmer, a big speech rebutting everything that Trump says. I don't think that was ever on the cards. But it'd be really interesting to know how the parliamentary party is feeling right now about that relationship and what it says about their own prime minister.
Yeah, and even though it was obviously a bit of a bromance, there were still moments in that Oval Office meeting where Keir Starmer called out Donald Trump, whether it was the money to Ukraine, whether it was on free speech and J.D. Vance's comments, whether it was on Putin and the threat that he created, or more crucially, whether it was on Ukraine being at the heart of any negotiations about its own future and that peace having to be enduring. There was just a few moments where he just interrupted and said his bit. Mm. So it wasn't a Love Actually
like
moment.
Macron did as well.
Exactly. Mm. It wasn't a Love Actually moment, but it was his own much more gentle way of making sure that our national interests were heard.
Well, that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. We'll be back with a regular episode on Monday. And you can also get in touch by sending us an email or a voice note to politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com.
And for more on that trip and how things are going for Trump domestically, you can listen to the latest episode of our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, with Johnny Friedland. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love The Audio Long Read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow The Audio Long Read wherever you get your podcasts.